Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Dylan C. Pendergroth. He is a professor of law and history at the University of California, Berkeley, recipient of the MacArthur Fellowship and author of the award-winning The Clans of Kinfolks. He lives in Kensington, California. And Dylan, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you for having me.
I will tell you that the title of the book immediately drew me in. Before the Movement, The Hidden History of Black Civil Rights. And the first thought I had was the hidden history of Black civil rights. And so one of the things I want to talk to you about is this notion of the great leader history versus the people history. And it came to my attention first years ago with the People's History of the United States. I believe that book was written by Howard Zinn, and how there tends to be, when it comes to history, a lot of focus on the great people, but not a lot of focus or attention given to the people who are doing the work day by day. So I just wanted your thoughts about how this history is presented.
That's a great question. And it's really in line with the way that historians, African-American historians, have been changing the way that we think about the civil rights movement and about African-American history in general. It's true that for a long time, after the movement itself, starting in the 1960s, historians tended to write the story of Black civil rights from the top down. So they would write about King, they would write about Malcolm X, and they would sort of take it for granted that the story of the so-called followers would follow that lead. But over the past 30 years or so, historians have really gotten interested in this, what they call grassroots histories of civil rights. And they've been interested in grassroots histories of African Americans more broadly for a long time. So if you think about a movie like Selma, it's really centered on Dr. Martin Luther King, but you can see glimpses of that bottom-up story when you see episodes or little scenes like the one involving Annie Lee Cooper. So she's played by Oprah Winfrey, and around the middle of the movie, she goes and tries to register to vote. So she's at the county courthouse, and she's very nervous, very scared, and the voter registrar treats her horribly, and she is not able to register. She walks away humiliated and in tears. And by the end of the movie, she's out in front with a lot of demonstrators, surrounded by people, the grassroots essentially, and King is kind of off to the side of this. And she's the one who initiates what turns out to be one of the turning points of the movie. When the sheriff comes down and tells the crowd to disperse, she hits him with her pocketbook and starts a melee. So that's kind of a way that you can see historians and movie makers kind of elevating the voices of the grassroots. But there's something embedded in that story that I think is quite misleading. And that is the impression that African Americans were never in Southern County courthouses before that movement. I think that that's not true. And I think that because I've spent about 20 years looking at records from county courthouses all across the South. And I've found that people like Annie Lee Cooper, people like my great-great-great uncle and aunt, were actually in county courthouses and outside of county courthouses. They were dealing with law all the time. Well, but they just weren't dealing with voting rights.
I want to jump in here because I actually think that, I've been involved myself for many, many years.
Sure.
I think we all love a good movie. We love inspirational leaders. We love that side. But for those who have, maybe this is a perspective of those who've been involved in organizations and associations and movements and all that. For those who've been involved, whether it's the NAACP, the Urban League, fraternities, sororities, I would argue that those people who have been active and involved know this. They know that it's people day by day. If you look, for example, at the NAACP Federal Credit Union, which was started in the late 1960s, it was started, and this actually fits into some of the things you cover in the book, because it was started because a Black teacher was not allowed to join the teachers' credit union. Mm-hmm. And she was just one of many Black teachers who could not join the credit union. So the NAACP started the NAACP Federal Credit Union. And one of the things I really find fascinating about your book is the role of associations and how we started all these different organizations and associations. But I do want to give you a chance to respond to my contention that we love our great leaders, but I know we know that we've been surviving and moving forward over many, many years here in this country before the great leaders made the great leaps that happened with, you know, Brown versus Topeka Board of Education, you know, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, so on and so forth.
That's absolutely right. We're hungry for great leaders, but I think we're also hungry to connect with the rank and file. And so I think that's one reason for the way that a lot of historians and movie makers, popular movies, are now focusing on both. But your point about the credit union and the role of associations, I think, is a really important one. And it ties back, just as you said, to your initial question, because associations are a way, you think about one kind of association, a corporation. It's a way of organizing resources, whether it be money or people's energies, into a form that can make a difference. So you're concentrating resources. A corporation is a really powerful legal tool for enabling that to happen. Now, there are pluses and minuses to this, because, you know, the plus, of course, is that you can concentrate resources in the hands of a few people, like a president and a board of directors. The downside, of course, is that the president and the board of directors may not always reflect the will of the members. And that's a dynamic that you see playing out from the very beginning in the very first Black corporations back in 1796 in Bethel AME Church of Philadelphia, and going all the way through the Black fraternities that get founded after the Civil War, through the founding of the NAACP and its Legal Defense Fund, down to today. There is always this dynamic tension that has to be navigated between the advantages of corporate organization, which enable people to pool their resources and make a difference, and struggles over the rights and privileges of members.
You really document what I will call the infighting that happens. And frankly, it's just kind of a part of life. I think there's a tendency that we want our history to be without any problems. We want this sort of natural, everyone got along, people got together and moved forward. But, you know, I've been part of organizations for 40 years, and conflicts and disagreements that may raise to the level of court, that's just sort of the natural part of the world. And I think your attempt with this book to share some of the stuff that went on, I think is important in terms of learning what to expect when you get into the real world. Like I was sharing the story with my daughter, you know, she's on the debate team, and she's gotten an understanding of the conflicts that are inherent in human relationships. And there's a tendency sometimes with movies, even though every writer will tell you that I talk to novelists, well, we got to have conflict, but everyone overcomes the conflict, or the movie overcomes the conflict, and they get to the triumphant moment. But there isn't always triumphant moments. And I think what's important with what you've written is just to let people know, with all the different organizations, associations, one that we were forming organizations and associations, a lot of them, to serve the purposes to meet the needs of the community. But also there was a lot of infighting, and people need to be, in my mind, in terms of looking at your book as not just learning history for just the sheer knowledge of it, but the practicality of what to expect, knowing that Abraham Lincoln lost in 1856 to Stephen Douglas for Senate and defeated him in 1860, and the struggles he had as a leader is instructive of what the struggles are truly in life, and they're not being, all the flaws and challenges and issues are not just being swept to the side.
That's so true. And one of the things that I try to highlight in this book is to show that people disagreed about all sorts of things, including their ideas about what the struggle was about. So there, you know, someone like Martin Luther King, he comes into Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, and in his very first sermon, he preaches that the members have to be subordinate to the minister. So long as he doesn't exceed his authority, the members have to follow, and the leader leads, and he is the leader, and everything will flow through him. And then the next thing he does is he lays out this elaborate program that centralizes all the finances of the church and most of the decision-making power in his hands. Now, we all know what happens. They swung in behind him, but that was a power play, pure and simple. And in other churches, that sort of power play led to serious dissent. That kind of dissent was not necessarily just about how best should we defeat segregation and white racism. Often it was about things that were not about race relations at all. It was about whether members had privileges or whether members actually had rights that they could defend in court. It was about control of money, you know, control of the finances. It was about who got to preach in the pulpit. These things don't necessarily fit into a race relations story. And so one of the things that I've tried to do in this book is to tell a story where race relations is part of the book, part of the story, but it's not the center. I think that often the way that Black history gets written, it puts race relations at the center, as if Black lives only matter when white people are somewhere in the picture. I think that's just not true. I wanted to make Black people, their struggles, their concerns, their ideas, their loves and hurts, and sometimes pettiness, I wanted to make Black people's lives the center of the story. And that's one thing that happens when you are able to look at conflicts and see them for what they really are.
You were inspired in part, you were talking about when you were in graduate school, there was a cassette.
Yeah.
And you heard an interview with a family member who talked about a family member, while I believe a slave, last name Holcomb, was paid by Confederate soldiers to ferry them across a body of water. And one of the things I remember reading, I don't know if you're familiar with the historian Juliet E.K. Walker, The History of Black Business in America, Capitalism, Race, et cetera. And I remember, you know, reading her book some 25 years ago, many, many years ago, and interviewing her on my show, and just waking up to the fact that there were Black-owned businesses, slaves-owned businesses, that the world of us participating in society, howbeit, however we were restricted, that still Black folks were still doing business, still starting businesses, still getting paid to do business, serving as slaves and still able to sell their time to other people and earn money for themselves while they were slaves. Talk about how that privilege, those rights, those laws, how did that work?
That's a great question. So the story that that you're referring to is about my great-great-great uncle Jackson Holcomb, who was enslaved in Southside, Virginia, in a little place called Cumberland County. And I remember growing up, my mom would always talk about the mother country this and the mother country that. And she was always talking about Cumberland County. And sometimes we went down there and we would visit Jackson Holcomb's son. Thomas Holcomb. He would come down with us from South Orange, New Jersey. Now, Thomas Holcomb recorded a tape with my uncle, Craig Baskerville, in 1976 when I was 5 years old. And this is just before Thomas Holcomb died. And one of the stories that Thomas Holcomb tells on that cassette tape is about how Jackson Holcomb, toward the end of the Civil War, had a boat. And when Confederate soldiers, having lost the battle at Richmond, were running through the woods in Southside, Virginia, they came to his boat at the shore of the Appomattox River, and he rowed them across. And when they got to the other side, the soldiers paid him. And so, you know, I had heard this story before, and I listened to it again on tape when I was in graduate school, and it suddenly hit me. That's a very strange twist to the story. So these are Confederate soldiers. They're fighting to defend slavery. They're, by definition, they're white supremacists. They are also heavily armed. They could have just taken his boat, but instead they paid him. And I sort of began to think, well, why did they do that? And over the course of my research, I came to realize that the reason that they paid him is because they were used to doing things like that. It was common for white Southerners to make bargains, to make deals with enslaved people for goods and services. It was common for white Southerners to see enslaved African Americans having property, having possessions that even the white Southerners talked about as property, quote unquote. Now that brings into the thing that you just said a minute ago, which is about privileges and rights. Slaves didn't have rights. By definition, an enslaved person couldn't have had rights. And the courts were very clear about that, except when they weren't, because the courts knew what white Southerners knew and what virtually everyone in the South knew, which is that slaves had certain privileges, like the privilege of earning money after hours. You know, you work a long day in the field and then you come home and you work at night to earn property, raising chickens or working in a garden to raise food and then selling it at the market on Sundays. Slaves had these certain privileges that white Southerners and black Southerners respected. And so that starts to get into this really interesting, murky area when we ask ourselves, well, what is a right at all? What do we mean when we say that someone has property rights? And in the end, you know, in daily life, what it means is that a right to property is a prerogative that people around you respect. But what turns it from a privilege into a right at the end of the day is that if someone took it from you, then a court could and would protect it. A judge would make a decision in your favor. That's the one thing that slaves didn't have. So if the soldiers had taken Jackson Holcomb's boat from him, he couldn't have gone to court about it. But the fact that they didn't and the fact that they paid him suggests that his prerogative to have a boat and to make bargains was strong enough that usually white people respected it. We could talk about why white people respected it. That's a whole nother story, which actually takes us into the world of critical race theory. But, you know, for now, I think it's just enough to sort of highlight this distinction between privileges and rights, because that sort of points us toward thinking about what difference did freedom make.
Well, this actually makes me remember what was the Dred Scott decision, yeah, which basically said blacks had, we had no rights.
They had no rights which a white man was bound to respect.
Wow. I remember reading that 40 years ago.
But, you know, the way that you could read that would be to put emphasis on the word bound.
Yes. Right?
And so who binds the white man to respect another person's privilege or right? A right, the binding is done by a court of law. But, you know, a white man could be bound by what an earlier generation of law scholars called community opinion. And so that is what underpins enslaved people's privileges of property and privileges of contract. And what's so interesting about those privileges is that although they can't protect them as rights, they're grounded in the same network of understandings about
custom is what I think of.
Yeah, it's like custom, and it's the same world of custom that white people's property rights are anchored in. It's not the same. They can't go to court. They don't have rights, but the logic of the system is similar.
I keep thinking while you're talking back to when the country was founded and who actually had rights to vote, for example. So few people had rights to vote. I believe you had to be a white male and you had to own property when this country was founded to be able to vote. So it's not as if this country from its very founding made rights universally available.
That's right. That's right. So the rights are up to the states. They're sort of defined locally. States can abridge all sorts of rights, define them almost however they want. But the baseline guarantees of rights are laid out in the Constitution. And that's one reason why the Civil War and the freeing of enslaved people make such a huge difference, because it lays out, especially with respect to voting rights, in 1870, the 15th Amendment lays out a set of minimum, not guarantees, but a set of minimum prohibitions, things that the states can't abridge. And one of them is that the states can't abridge voting rights on the basis of race.
I want to go back to the Montgomery Improvement Association being founded in 1956 with centralized powers. One of the things you do in the book is you contrast them with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which you write refused to act anything like a corporation. And they had a group-centered leadership model. And just 7 years after its founding, it collapsed. So were there lessons you learned about centralization of power under these corporations as opposed to decentralization of power, and how you saw the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, failed?
I think so. And I think people, even at the time, drew those lessons. John Lewis was a member of SNCC and one of its leaders. And he complained in his memoir about SNCC's unwillingness to centralize authority, its unwillingness to empower leaders to direct the activities of the organization. So SNCC wanted this very radical, democratic, decentralized decision-making structure. And the reason that they wanted it is because they wanted to empower the grassroots. We were talking earlier about grassroots history, and SNCC was all about the people, the folk, the grassroots. And so they refused to let leaders have the power to discipline members. They wouldn't let leaders of SNCC have the power really to speak for the organization. They wanted to empower the rank and file. But what they didn't really pay enough attention to, in my opinion, is that some people from the local communities they were recruiting from and who they wanted to empower, many of them actually wanted more structure, more organization, more power centralized in the leaders, basically because they thought that it would allow SNCC to get stuff done better. But the organizers, the student organizers, many of whom were college students, they didn't want that. They had this philosophy of radical democracy. And that's one reason, I think, why SNCC collapsed after 7 years. By contrast, as you mentioned earlier, the Montgomery Improvement Association, which is founded in the wake of Rosa Parks' arrest in Montgomery, Alabama, about 6 months into the bus boycott, they incorporate the Montgomery Improvement Association, and Martin Luther King is one of the incorporators. He actually becomes its president, I believe. And the papers, the incorporation papers, actually say pretty clearly that King and the board of directors are going to have a lot of power. King is the one who is empowered to speak for the MIA. King is the one who has the power to make financial decisions. You know, they're taking in thousands of dollars each month and then spending it on carpools and things like that. He has the power to do that in a way that the SNCC leaders do not. And I think that's one big reason why the MIA was able to last for 13 months through such ferocious opposition by white supremacists. They were able to do it in part because they centralized authority.
One of the themes of the book is you talk about how African Americans used corporations both in a public sense and a private sense, in that through, and I'm quoting you here, through constant organizing to feed and clothe the poor, Black-run associations provided the safety net that white-run governments withheld. And just by existing, they represented a challenge to the white supremacist assumption that Blacks were too primitive to govern themselves. Could you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. So if you think about, you know, the way that most white Americans perceived African Americans in 1790 or 1850, or for that matter, 1950, many white Americans assumed that Black Americans were inferior. And one of the things that they really believed strongly was that Black Americans did not have the capacity for self-governance, both in their personal lives and collectively. So the power for self-governance in your personal life involves things that you'd associate with morality, so sexual incontinence. And that's where you get all these nasty stereotypes about promiscuity. But it also pertains to group self-government. And so white Americans often believed that Black people didn't have the capacity, the intellectual, the moral capacity to be in charge of any government. That's why they opposed Black people voting, because after all, a democracy is one where the people rule. This stereotype of Black incapacity for self-governance is probably the biggest reason why white Americans so often opposed empowering Blacks with the right to vote. And so when Black people formed their own associations, like fraternities, like the NAACP, like churches, they were proving, just through the fact of their organization and the success of their organizations, they were proving that they actually did have the capacity for governance. They were proving that they were worthy of the vote, of a share in American democracy. And so there is this really interesting dynamic that develops where Black-run associations, businesses, churches, and the like, they come into existence often because they've been rejected by white Americans, right? So you can have like a white fraternity or a white insurance company. Black people want to become a member of it, and whites reject them, rejected from white churches and so forth. And so Black people go off and found their own, and they feel that they're going to prove their worthiness as citizens by acting responsibly in this Black-run organization in a Black world of their own. And so they have a duty to the race, right? They're going to care for the Black poor. They're going to show that they can govern themselves in their own spaces. But then at the same time as this duty to the race, there's also this this sense of duty to the members, where, right, so the leaders are leading the members in this struggle against white supremacy, but at the same time, there is this very natural and very human dynamic that develops when the members disagree with the leaders. And so what responsibility do the leaders have to the members of a church or to the shareholders of a Black-owned corporation? That's where a lot of the fighting comes out, is because leaders and members often disagree about what the purpose of a Black-run corporation actually is. Is it to fight white supremacy and that alone? Can Martin Luther King come in and say, I have all the authority and all the power and I'm going to use it? I'm going to use this church to fight against racism? Or does Martin Luther King actually owe a duty to the members to let the church govern itself and direct its energies maybe also in other directions?
Isn't this also about how do you manage scarce resources?
Exactly.
Because you have examples in there where the members are fighting the leadership because of the resources the organization is devoting to fighting white supremacy in court.
Yes. Yes, that's right. And sometimes the members even say cynical things. I'm thinking of one in particular where there was a Black run fraternal organization that functioned partly as an insurance company. And there was a big leadership battle coming up. And the leader of the organization came out with a statement that the organization could not and should not meet the next year in Texas. I think it was scheduled to meet in Dallas, and that he wasn't going to go and the organization shouldn't go either because Dallas was a Jim Crow state. Some of the members started grumbling and saying, oh, the reason you don't want to go there is because your biggest rival for the presidency is there and you might lose. So you're essentially using this struggle against racism to kind of cover up what really is an internal power struggle. Things are not always that cynical, but there is this kind of interplay between the duty to the race and the duty to the members.
But isn't also the view that your leadership is going to purely 100% serve the interests of the members kind of idealistic? I remember many conversations over the years where people were upset. Well, you know, they're not doing what's best for the organization. They're just doing what's best for themselves, because sometimes being presidents of these organizations and associations are stepping steps to higher office.
Of course.
And I just think sometimes the reality is, maybe one of my favorite example is, I don't care why they choose to be a leader. If they move the organization forward, whether it's to position themselves to run for office in the future, whatever, I don't really don't care, as long as they're moving the organization forward.
Sure.
Did you find, as you studied these cases, was there that cynicism? Were there people who said, you're only doing this because you're trying to position yourself for something else, so you're just really using this organization to get you to another place?
I think I saw occasionally that sort of cynicism, but more often it was a genuine and deeply heartfelt disagreement about what direction actually represented forward movement for the organization. People just genuinely disagreed about what the corporation is for. There's a, you know, an interesting way that the language of civil rights gets kind of used and reused, repurposed between leaders and members. So there's an example that I remember where in 1966, a woman named Vernita Wimbush, who's a member of the Christian Methodist Episcopal Church of Washington, D.C., she writes to the bishop of the CME Church and saying that she and most of the members of her congregation of the CME in Washington, D.C., want to keep their minister, but the bishop is trying to remove him and take him somewhere else and replace him with someone they don't like. And so what she does is she writes to the bishop and she says, do you remember the March on Washington of 1963, 3 years earlier? Do you remember you told all of us, members of the church, to go and march for our rights as American citizens? Well, we are about to march on your house, the bishop's house, to fight for our rights as members of the CME church. And so there's this way that the language of civil rights is not something that we can take for granted. People are using it in creative ways, sometimes unexpected ways, and they really disagree about what civil rights are and what direction the language of civil rights can move their organizations.
You looked at 14,000 civil cases from 24 courthouses in 5 states in the District of Columbia, and you identified 1,500 that involved Black people. The first thing I'm going to ask is, did you have to get a new eyeglasses prescription after that?
Sometimes I wondered, doing that work was challenging, to say the least.
But you had help.
Rewarding. I had help. I had some of the most amazing research assistants, graduate students in the history departments at Northwestern, people working for the American Bar Foundation and at University of California, Berkeley. Incredibly gifted students all, and they helped me work through these cases. The thing that they helped the most with, and this is going to sound strange, is they helped me figure out which one of these cases involved Black people. When I started this project, I went into, you know, county courthouses thinking, well, I'll just go to the Black Ledger books and see what cases Black people were bringing. Turns out that they didn't mark race on those court records. They almost never marked race on court records. Neither did they mark it on property deed books. So this is a surprise. And there's kind of an interesting story behind why they're not marking it. But the practical problem, of course, is I had no way of knowing which cases are being brought by Black people. And so what my research assistants and I did is I would go out to the courthouse. I'd take a plane or drive down to Clarksdale, Mississippi, or Cumberland County, Virginia. And I would bring a camera and I would photograph docket pages from as many of these docket books as I could. And then I would take that back home, and it's handwritten. All of this is handwritten and it is not digitized. And so what we would do is we would look up, we would key in, we'd write down the names of all the people in the cases, and then we looked them up on ancestry.com. And it's not just the DNA swab from your cheek. They actually have a digitized version of the U.S. Census, and you can look up your relatives and you can look up people from court cases. So one thing that I think your listeners might be interested to take away is that this story, this hidden history of Black civil rights, is really all around us. All you have to do is go to your county courthouse. You go inside, you pull down docket books, and you can actually, if you spend some time, you will find cases, you will find property deeds belonging to Black people. They're not going to be marked that way. But if you know what you're doing and you go to Ancestry, you can actually find these incredible stories on the dockets and then the case files of Black people using law, talking about law, and thinking about law in their daily lives.
What motivated you to look at the legal lives of Black people?
I think it was two things. One was realizing that story of Jackson Holcomb was at bottom partly a legal story, right? Like, how could a man who didn't have rights because he was a slave, how could he own a boat? How could he make deals? So partly it's coming out of these kind of intellectual questions that I'm asking. But the other part of it is that court records turn out to be an incredible resource, not just for thinking about law, but for thinking about Black life in general. You can get a window onto parts of Black life that are really hard to get at any other way. Intimate parts, emotional parts. So, for example, elder care. Again, this is something that does not really fit within a freedom struggle narrative. But what did our ancestors do when they got old? How did they try to provide for their old age in a world before Social Security? When you could not count on an insurance payout or anything else. And it turns out that one of the things they did is they made bargains with their children and with loved ones who weren't their children. I'll give you what I have when my life is over if you promise to take care of me. Right? And so people make these deals all the time. This is the way that many white people did elder care too. But you can see already there's like a built-in potential for conflict because maybe the old person thinks that the care they're getting is not what they bargained for. And so then they go back on the deal and they say, I'm actually going to give it to someone else. Or another relative who's a blood relative comes in and says, wait, how are you giving your house to this person who isn't even a member of our family? You should have given it to us, the real nieces and nephews. And so those sorts of disagreements wind up sometimes in court. And once they wind up in court, someone starts writing stuff down. And when things get written down, that's when the historian can come and find it. It's sort of these small traces of the past that come down to us. And you were talking at the beginning about leaders versus ordinary people. It's relatively easy to find out what Martin Luther King was thinking because he wrote a lot. He often wrote down what he thought. It's much harder to get a record of what ordinary people thought. And one way, it turns out, to find out what ordinary people cared about, how they felt, their loves and angers and disappointments, it often comes out in court cases.
What advice would you give up-and-coming leaders of today? Based on what you've learned from your study of history, specifically what you've learned from reviewing in your book, Before the Movement, the Hidden History of Black Civil Rights, you've had an opportunity to review thousands of court cases, and you've had so you've had both the big picture view and the minutia view. So what advice would you give up-and-coming leaders of today to navigate today's world based on what you've learned from the past?
That's a great question. I mean, I think one piece of advice, and again, I'm just a historian. I'm not an organizer. I have no expertise or experience in it. But if history holds any lessons, you know, a couple of them might be this. Just as you said, the minutiae matters a lot, and so does the big picture. And connecting them is often the challenge. One kind of minutiae has to do with law. And so often, I think that Black people's engagement with law gets presented as if it's all about federal law, all about these famous enactments like the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and Brown versus Board of Education. And those made an enormous difference, of course. I wouldn't be sitting here talking with you if it hadn't been for those changes in the law. But sometimes I think it can be difficult to connect all that highfalutin, you know, 30,000 feet, you know, federal law to kind of what's going on the ground in your organization. And so I think it can really help if we think about law as being more than the Supreme Court and Congress. Law is all around us. It's in the papers that your organization is filing. It's the tax returns. It's the licenses that you have to obtain. It's the deeds to the building and the leases to the building. Those are, in fact, exercises of civil rights. And just the daily conduct of your organization is actually part of this long story of Black civil rights that goes back to the 1827 Frederick Douglass and Freedom's Journal, goes back to the 1790s with Bethel AME. That, I think, connecting the big picture highfalutin law to the small everyday life of the law, I think that's one lesson. I think the other lesson that I at least have taken away from looking at this over the years is this sense of Black people's engagement with law. So we often, I think these days, have rightly been concerned with the prevalence of anti-Black violence, especially by members of the police. And I think that one of the things that comes out of the kind of research that I've been doing is a realization that that kind of violence can exist, and in fact always has existed, with Black people's everyday engagement, everyday use of law. Black people put their faith in law. They put their faith in rights, even as they face this enormous and violent oppression that would make anyone normal question their faith in law. And so I think it's important for us to ask ourselves, why did our ancestors continue to put their faith in the rule of law? And I think that's especially important for us to ask now that one of our two major political parties, the Republican Party, is actively trying to undermine Americans' faith in the rule of law.
Dylan C. Pentegroth, author of Before the Movement, The Hidden History of Black Civil Rights. This has been an incredibly informative book. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.